The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I think that the central banks have manipulated a bit too much over the last 15, 20 years. I don't know that they can do that going forward. And this is one of the reasons why I'm such a tremendous gold bug. To me, gold is the currency of last resort. So it's very easy to see at some point we're all depending upon gold, and that's how we base every other currency.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Our guest today, Alan Newman. We promised that last week. Dave, I just have to go back and look at a memory here because we're in this amazing period of time where the stock market continues to rise just unstoppably. You know, we haven't even had a correction of more than 3% in the last year. You know, we have margin debt hitting highs like we did back in 2000. We've got Bitcoin inexplicably just continuing to go through the roof. It feels very much like that period of time right after we didn't have Y2K, and we went January, February, and then finally a crash in March. And I remember this man that we read on a regular basis, Alan Newman, on February 28th, 2000, when everything seemed like it would never go down, he said within 6 weeks, we're going to see this market crash at least 35%. And nobody was saying that at the time. And sure enough, just a few days later, it crashed, and Alan Newman was found to be right. There's so many things we could say, Dave, but I think it's important that we look at the context of the market, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, context is important. At a market bottom, you see high yields, lots of stress, and valuations which are compelling, but relatively uninteresting due to the dominant feeling in the marketplace, which is dominated by fear. So people are generally ignoring opportunities at a market low. And that's in contrast with what we see today. You have very low yields. Notably, this last week we had the Greek 10-year treasury dip below 5%. For the first time since 2009. You can go back in time and you remember the magic 5%, and you used to get that in a conservatively rated bank CD. And now you've got to go to the almost bankrupt Isles of Greece for it. I think Icarus would be looking at this and laughing. Today, the fear that's in the marketplace is interesting. The fear is of, you can put it in an acronym, FOMO, fear of missing out. The spirit of the age is greed, and that's what dominates today. Alan Newman, you're back on the program with us. You've been a newsletter writer for 28 years, a market observer for more than five decades. So there's some similarities and differences, I'm sure, between what you see now and what you've seen in the past. 77 years old, you know, when I think of a doctor, doctors perform hundreds or even thousands of the same procedures. And, you know, they see every permutation possible, and they get a real sense of what's in front of them. Part of that's because they're connecting dots, and a part of it's at a more intuitional level, where they're probably still connecting dots, but maybe it's just subconscious. What is your sense, if we shift this to Dr. Newman, Dr. Newman, what is your sense of the markets today? As you connect dots, what are you intuiting?
Well, I've actually seen instances like this before. You made a very good point about market bottoms where the market is just ruled by fear. And you have the complete opposite. You don't have it as often because fear is more often in the market than greed. But you have instances like you had in 1929 with the Roaring Twenties, that you had in 1972 with the Nifty 50, that you had in 2000 with the tech stocks, in 2007 in a dual-double, stocks and housing, and you're having the same thing today. This is a very rare occasion where greed just completely overtakes fear. And it's like the surgeon who's looking at the patient, and he shouldn't be alive, but he is. He's not only alive, he's running around the track. There's something very mysterious going on here. It's going to end very poorly, as it did in 2007, as it did in 2000, as it did in 1972, as it did in 1929. There's just no way to pin down and say, okay, this is the peak. Today is it. We're going to crash from here. But from what I see, over five decades plus of experience, we have entered that window where I'm not just looking at the possibility of a bear market ahead. I'm looking at the possibility of another halving in prices at some point. Looking at valuation measures like Shiller's cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, it's called CAPE, CAPE, that's over 31. And it's only been there once before, and that was in 2000 with the tech bubble. It got close in 2007, it got close in 1929, but believe it or not, it's higher than it was in 1929. If you take the mean or the median for CAPE, we're going to be down about 48%. So, all right, that's close enough to a halving in price. The technical work that I do for a couple of years now has pointed to 14,719 on the Dow. And I've always wondered about that. And that number is now over 40% down. So I'm pretty certain this is going to happen. I just can't tell you when, but I think it's going to happen in the Trump administration.
Well, you and I operate with a sense of history. And frankly, from 2009 to the present, we've had records of all sorts which have been taken out. And so you look at young market practitioners today, and history is fading in terms of its significance. Did we get to the end of history without getting the memo?
I think what you have is a period where whoever is going into stocks is more or less just relying on the indexes. They're going into ETFs. And what happens in a situation like that, the ETF doesn't care how their constituents are valued. It just buys every single one of them. So we're in a period where valuations are bogus. They're not real. So you have stocks like Amazon, that I think is grossly overvalued. And you have other stocks that are grossly undervalued because they're not bought because they have a good outlook. They're bought because they're in the index. That's it. That's the only reason they're bought. It's bad for investors over the long term.
Let's look at the role of leverage in this cycle. How significant has leverage been in levitating equity prices, you know, since 2008, 2009?
I did a lot of research back in, let's say, the mid-60s. My dad had some stock. He had been a broker in 1929, and he just threw it in a vault after the crash, and it was my job to take everything out and take a look at it. And I was down at the business library in Brooklyn every single day for about 6 hours. And I went through a lot of books, and I found statistics from the New York Stock Exchange about margin debt going back as far as about 1926. And I was blown away. Unfortunately, I can't find that information again. I did have it, but margin debt was about 11% of total market cap in those days. It was just a mind-boggling figure. It's worse than what tulip mania was in 1636. So that record is never going to be broken. But what we've seen since is a gigantic record in over-leverage, excess leverage in 2000 with the tech bubble, again in 2007, and again now, and each one of those excessive peaks in leverage has been far worse than the one before it. We're at a point where the way I calculate it is I take total margin debt, which includes NASD besides the NYSE, and I subtract absolute levels of mutual fund cash. And I come up with a number of about minus $275 billion. So that is what I think right now is net demand. Now, if net demand is actually negative by minus $275 billion, why are we still going up? It's just that type of a crazy period. It's a mania. There's really no way to call a top. The only thing you know going forward is when that peak happens, the denouement is just going to be ridiculous. It's going to be the kind of situation where you go out to the bathroom and you come back and what? We're 2,000 points lower? How'd that happen? I've seen it before and I'm pretty sure we're going to see it again.
You know, you've got the last 12 months where we're not seeing intraday declines of greater than 3%. Volatility has largely been vanquished. And, you know, you factor in margin debt as a percentage of GDP. Couldn't you argue that the central bankers / central planners have changed the markets and, you know, have just promised us a brave new world where it only goes up?
Absolutely. They certainly have. But it's a bogus theory. You can't do that. You can't promise we'll always go up, because what you're doing is you're corrupting any semblance of value. And in the end, you have to have value. You have to have something that you're paying for that makes sense, that's logical. And I'm sorry, Netflix is not logical. Neither is Amazon. There's quite a few stocks like that. Neither is Facebook.
So, yeah, I mean, coming back to market dynamics associated with periods of rising leverage, this has been pretty awesome to witness prices increasing as they have. The unwind of leverage, can you tell us a little bit about how that dynamic looks? Two steps forward, one step back, or is it a little bit more vicious than that?
We're in a period of what I term groupthink. I learned more by reading David Dreeman's book, Psychology in the Stock Market, which he wrote, I think, 1975, showing how groupthink overtook money managers in 1971 and 72 at the Nifty 50. You have a similar situation now where it's momentum, and the momentum is, I'm doing so well, and I'm now embarrassing you as a money manager, and you have to go in and buy Netflix and Amazon so you can keep up the chatter with me. So this spreads from you to another guy, to Joe, then to Charlie, and then everybody is buying the same stocks at ridiculous multiples. The company's outlook cannot possibly justify the price. Not only to buy it, you're now going to be even more courageous and you're going to buy it on margin. So that's how it builds. And it just crescendos to a point at which there's no way it can't be supported, and then the bottom drops out. It kind of happened in 1987. It was slightly different then, but 1987 did show us how fast prices can decline.
You know, in the fixed income market, you've got an artificial buyer in the form of central banks. Within the stock market, outside of the Nikkei, where obviously the Bank of Japan is actively participating, but in the U.S. stock markets, you do have something that looks like an artificial buyer, that is, companies buying back their own shares. What can you tell us about that and its role in driving prices higher?
Well, that may have ended. There has been a big bulge in stock buybacks from corporations, and we got up to about a net 12-month rolling total of $590 billion. It's down to $500 billion. So that's a significant decline, and if that continues down, that's one of the biggest sources of demand for stocks. It's about the same size as margin debt. Right now, margin debt is $608 billion. So if you've gone from a net positive $590 billion in stock buybacks to $500, you're taking, if not the biggest, the second biggest source of demand away. I also think that corporations are flush now with their own shares. There really is no reason for them to continue buying back stocks. They are aware of price earnings multiples. They are aware of overvaluation. Maybe they could make a case for it a year ago at lower multiples. They can't possibly make a case for it now.
Yeah, so we talked about leverage. Can you also share with us your thoughts on liquidity? It's generally believed that the investment public has been on the sidelines. There's trillions that could come into the market. We just talked about the corporate buybacks being a source of liquidity, and that may be going away. Mutual funds, low levels of liquidity. What do you see from the standpoint of liquidity?
Well, what's happened in the ETF era is that people have been liquidating mutual funds as much now as ever. We're averaging for domestic funds about $20 billion exiting mutual funds each month, maybe a little more than that. And I don't think you quite have the same inflow for ETFs. So over time, the little guy has been pulling out of the market. And this is quite understandable. After being absolutely savaged from the results of the tech mania and then being savaged again in 2008 and 2009, if people are going to put money in stocks, they're just going to put in little monthly payments to ETFs, which again overvalues a lot of stocks. Over time, this is a very bad procedure. We now have the way I calculate it, which is total margin debt minus absolute cash levels of mutual funds minus $275 billion in demand. And it was as bad as minus 290. We're not that far away. I mean, we're still at terrible, terrible levels. We're lower, much lower than we were in 2000, much lower than we were in 2007. Basically, you have four downturns. I mean, real huge downturns. There was one in 2000 that was historic, then the one in 2007 that was even much more historic, and then in 2015, which resulted in about a 16 or 17% correction, that's all. But now, the bottom that we have is just beyond anything that I ever thought was possible. But it's there, and it's telling me the same thing. There's just tremendous excess leverage that's driving stocks, and when this reverses, it always reverses very quickly. It can't reverse slowly, because if I'm buying stocks on margin, if I'm down 10%, I'm actually down 20%, because I'm buying on 50% margin. If I'm down 50%, I've lost everything. So you have to get out very quickly. And everybody just follows one another, and it's like lemmings jumping off the cliff, and prices go down very rapidly.
When you see something at a generational low, like your volatility indicators, or on the other extreme, you see things at generational highs, like FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and they begin to make the Nifty 50 mania look mild by comparison, what do you do?
Well, you always want to take the opposite tack. So when you see a period of tremendous complacency like this, obviously this complacency is the overall driver right now, you want to be very concerned. When there's a lot of fear, like in March 2009, then you want to be a buyer. And I was one of the biggest bears around, but even in March 2009, I could see the prices had gone down too much. It was the time to buy. When everybody's buying, that's the time you want to be very fearful. So right now, we're seeing as much complacency as I have seen in over 50 years, and you see it in the volatility. There is almost a complete lack of volatility, which is a complete lack of concern. The players don't care. They'll buy. They'll actually stick it out for a minor decline. Right now, that strategy is working. It won't work very soon.
You mentioned the bear market target for the Dow Jones Industrial Average of 14,719. Can you give us some insight as to how you arrive at that number?
Yeah, it's a support level. I did the same thing way back when. I gave a speech to the International Federation of Technical Analysts many years ago, and I offered targets then, a long-term bear market target of Dow 6400, SPX 680, NASDAQ 1000, and it is just working on support levels, what I determined to be long-term support levels drawn from charts, and it took a long time for those levels to be achieved. Didn't happen until 2008 and 2009, but they were achieved almost exactly. We got down to 64.69 on the Dow, so I was 69 points off. We got down to 666, I think, on the S&P. I was off 16 points there. I messed up on NASDAQ. We only got down to about 1250, and I was calling for 1,000. But, you know, when you make forecasts like this, you have to have some certainty. It's almost impossible to predict time and price together. Anybody who does it is going to wind up on the wrong side of the eight ball at some point. It's better if you just predict price because you know it's going to happen eventually. Here, I have been wondering for a long time, for actually a couple of years, why I have the 14,719 target when I'm looking for 40 to 50% down on the Dow. I mean, when we were back at 17 or 18,000, well, that's just a correction, 14,719. Well, now it's that 40% down. And it is taken from old Dow charts where I'm finding supports and resistances and coming up what I think is the most likely target. I don't expect it to be achieved exactly, but we'll be in that neighborhood at some point.
So considering the ratio of the Dow to gold, what does experience tell you we're likely to see in that ratio, and maybe even in the price of the now only occasionally shiny metal?
Well, you know what? You made a point a couple of months ago about the biggest asset reallocation of all time. That's exactly what I expect. I think that's a lot of what us gold bugs are looking for at some point. Gold is a currency. Right now, we're undergoing a very long consolidation. But when you look at what gold did, it went from $265 up to over $1,900 an ounce in a relatively short period of time, you would expect a long-term consolidation. So I'm not troubled by gold's action here. I've been looking for a consolidation range that gets us as high as 20.5 or 21 ratio for Dow to gold. I think we're about 19 now. So we could actually go a little lower, or the Dow could go a little higher, but I think that's about it. And I think at some point next year, we're going to see gold start to run towards what I believe is an equitable Dow to gold target ratio of between 5 and 6 to 1. That gets you up to, oh my gosh, close to $5,000 an ounce. And I never thought I'd see that. You know, for years I've been saying, okay, $3,000 an ounce. And I was wondering, how are people coming up with the $5,000 an ounce target? Now I know. It's there because stocks went a little crazy.
Yeah, and it's not likely that stocks are going to give it all back, but they might give 40 or 50% of it back. What does the metal look like in other currencies, and therefore in the minds of other investor bases elsewhere in the world?
Well, you know, that's the funny thing, because you're looking at it in dollars, and, you know, this thing has done nothing, it doesn't look good. But if you look at it in terms of the euro and the yen, it's fine. We're still in bull trends. The euro is kind of testing the support for the uptrend right now, but the yen looks fine, and it's only the dollar, and that's because the dollar has not been that good lately. But I think you have to measure gold by a wide variety of currencies to see how potential is. And as far as I'm concerned, it looks fine. It's just this very long consolidation mode. And in terms of the yen, oh my gosh, we're like 5% away from a new high. That's not much at all. It could be there in a few days.
Yeah, you get to Asia and it's a very different perspective, isn't it? Well, so activism among central bankers, speaking of Asia, Bank of Japan kind of captures everyone's imagination as to what you can do next. But activism among central bankers has been a dominant theme since 2009. Now you have a number of those bankers talking about normalizing interest rates and reducing their balance sheets. Do you think that that's just talk? And what would the consequences be if, in fact, they follow through?
I think it's just talk, because we're in such an unusual period that it's very hard to know how they can react going forwards. What if we do have some type of financial cataclysm a la, you know, 2008, where they do have to step in and save the entire financial system? You know, they can do it once or twice. They can't do it forever. I think that the central banks have manipulated a bit too much over the last 15, 20 years. I don't know that they can do that going forward. And this is one of the reasons why I'm such a tremendous gold bug. To me, gold is the currency of last resort. So it's very easy to see at some point we're all depending upon gold, and that's how we base every other currency.
You know, when we look at things from an emotional perspective, we've talked about markets, we've talked about them perhaps getting into a manic phase. What do you see as an indicator which would say, yeah, things are just way overdone? Bulls versus bears, RIDEX assets, investors' intelligence, even, you know, the Michigan indicators, if you're looking at more of an economic versus a market indicator in terms of just consumer sentiment. On a scale of 1 to 10, where are we at in terms of, you know, emotional-based indicators?
I started to keep a scale, a 0 to 10 scale, some months back. And I had it at 9 not long ago, and I kept on saying to myself, well, it's got to be so extraordinary for me to move this up to 10. And guess what? A couple of months ago, I did move it up to 10. And I feel firmly convinced that that 10 is an accurate reflection. You mentioned investors' intelligence. I think that is an excellent tally to look at. It's a poll of investment letter writers such as myself. And recently, we had 64% bulls. And frankly, I don't think I've ever seen that. My data doesn't go back far enough, but I can't remember seeing it that high. And average bears for quite some time has been around 15%. That's extraordinarily low. So you have a ratio of over 4 to 1. That's extraordinary. Again, what it tells you is not only are there too many bulls, there's too few bears, and there's way too much complacency in the market. Another indicator I like to look at is the RIDEX ratio, where you take the assets in RIDEX bull and sector funds and divide it by assets in the bear funds. And the assets in the bear funds have just been dwindling each and every month. I mean, people don't want to put money to protect the downside anymore. So they're not. And the ratio has gone up as high as 30 to 1. I've never seen that before. Never. So I'm seeing extremes everywhere I look. I'm seeing it in leverage. I'm seeing it in bullishness. I'm seeing it in bearishness. I'm seeing it in complacency. I'm seeing it in the prices, the PE ratios. I'm seeing it in valuations. What does it tell me? We're going to have one heck of a bear market.
You know, I don't know if you know this, but this last year, we partnered with Doug Noland, who managed the Prudent Bear Mutual Funds for about 16, almost 20 years. And, you know, to me, as a manager of a wealth management organization, this is, to me, one of those amazing value plays. When you have a 30-to-1 ratio of people investing on bullish trends versus bearish trends, and you've never seen this kind of lopsided, everyone shift to one side of the boat, to me, this is the story for 2017 and 2018. Well, are there other pockets of value? Are there other pockets of value in a world which, you know, is kind of priced for perfection?
Well, yes. I mean, like when you talk about the greatest asset reallocation, I certainly see tremendous value in gold stocks. If we're correct, and we're going to see an extraordinary move in gold at some point, and gold is looked at as the currency of last resort, you have gold miners that are presenting tremendous value. I'm not telling you that they're doing particularly well at this point, but I've had a base position in Newmont for many, many years and in Goldcorp. And, you know, I've traded some in and out as time has gone on, but I have those base positions. Although Goldcorp looks terrible right now, I'm tempted to buy more. That's GZ on the New York Exchange. I've had a nice position in IAM Gold, IAG, that also trades on New York, for a long time. It's a very speculative play, but I think it's an attractive speculation. Newmont, of course, is the diamond of the gold stocks, as it were. It's probably the best managed company of the bunch. And at one point when gold was forging way ahead, they had a dividend yield of over 7%. So I got some money back that way. It was a good investment then. I think it's a good investment now. So I think you see value in the gold stocks. I'm sure there are silver stocks and other precious metal stocks, or maybe lithium at this point. I just don't specialize then. I like gold. I stick with gold.
You know, Alan, my dad tells me of a number of companies that he owned in the 1970s and 80s, South African miners. The dividends that he received from them were greater than his original cost basis, 100% return of capital just in dividends. And, you know, I don't think investors have an imagination for what happens when you have a tremendous amount of wealth drop to the bottom line. Because your costs are relatively fixed, not completely, but relatively fixed. And with an inelastic asset like gold, all of a sudden, no one has the imagination for it. So I know you're speaking to a blind audience here. You don't know them. But could you advise the audience as if you needed to share a very meaningful insight, let's say with a grandson? So this is a crazy world we live in trying to get perspective on where we're at and where we're going. What is your sober advice to a family member just about where we're at and where we're going and how they should proceed?
Well, I'll say exactly what I've told people for 30 or 40 years. Do your own homework. Do your own research. Just listening to one other person may not get you where you want to go. But if you can do your own research and do your own homework, you'll probably form opinions that you'll have a lot more confidence in, and you'll be able to act and react a lot better than you would otherwise. So that's the best advice. Do your own homework. Do your own research. It's not that difficult.
Now, you've seen some of the grand old men who've written the greatest commentary of the last 50, 60 years. Alan Abelson, been on our program a number of times. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. Richard Russell, Joe Granville, Cy Harding, a number of people who brought so much insight into the world of finance. My question is this, where would you go for that kind of wisdom? Again, in a world where a lot of the experience isn't around anymore. I can't ask Richard Russell a question anymore. I can't call Westchester and dial up Alan Abelson and ask him a question anymore. Where do I go for something that is beyond the time that I'm stuck in, the age that I'm stuck in, the perspective that I'm stuck in, for someone who's been around and done that and brings a different perspective?
Well, I'll tell you what. You're not paying me to do this, but I would say go to David McIlvaney's site, because you have a lot of readers already, and obviously they're there because they're getting something of value. So I don't even know that you want to go to my website anymore. I'll give you the web address. It's www.crosscurrents. There's a dash between the words cross and currents, .net, not .com, .net. But I've been kind of inactive lately. I don't know what I'm going to be doing going forward. And the reason why is I'm an old codger. I'm 77. I do this as a labor of love. I expect to continue in some capacity. But if you're asking where to go, well, your site is as good as an answer as anybody's ever going to have. Like I say, you have a tremendous number of readers, and there's a reason why. Because you've been giving them good information all along.
Yeah, Alan, it's very kind. I would say Cross Currents as a labor of love is something that's of huge value to us, of huge value to your readers. And I understand a mixed priorities of, you know, personal life and family dynamics. And at 77, you say, but I also want to encourage you, if there's months where you feel like you're not getting the feedback that you need, I'm constantly asking my assistant, is it published yet? Did he publish it? When is it out? And we look with anticipation for that. I have a tremendous amount of respect for your work, and there's fewer and fewer people who bring solid technical analysis with a fundamental overlay to the market. And we need your insights. I would encourage you to keep them coming, but understand if things change, things change. But yeah, by all means, crosscurrents with a hyphen in between it, .net would be a great place to visit. Any final words of wisdom for us, Alan?
Be careful. I mean, I could have said the same thing at the exact top in 2007. I'm sure I did, because I called several tops in 2007. I know I said it on February 28th of 2000, because I wrote that newsletter, and that was my headline. And I said, NASDAQ's going to crash. By April, I expected to be down 35%. Well, it went up another 500 points before it started its crash, but sure enough, it was down in 6 weeks, 33%. So I've seen this before, and I feel exactly the same way. Just be careful.
Again, we go back to an earlier comment, and you know, a doctor who does thousands of procedures knows what he knows, in part because there are the logical inferences that are made. And so you have numbers and charts and things like that. But I'm also interested in your reflections, your intuitions, because again, there's nothing that can replace experience. Nothing that can replace experience. So at 77 and 53 years, is that right? 53 years market experience?
Yeah, 1964 was when I started. I was 24 years old.
When you're building on what was conversed about at dinner table conversations and things, your dad being a stockbroker through the 1929 crash, you know, be careful. As simple as that is, there's some added power in it because it's you who's saying it.
When you think about it, he was 30 years old in 1929, and he and his dad had accumulated a decent amount of stock. What caused them to take all of these certificates and lock them away in a safe deposit box and keep them there until 1964? What? How does anybody do that? That's how bad that crash was, that people thought it was never, ever going to come back. Okay, we'll take the paper, we'll lock it away. And it never saw the light of day for 35 years. In fact, I'll tell you a very interesting story. One of the stocks I took out of there, it was Amerex Corp. It was Chase National. And on the back of the certificate, it said Amerex Corp, A-M-E-R-E-X. What the heck is this? Took me a while to find out. It was the forerunner of American Express. He had $20,000 of American Express stock, $4,000 in dividends that he had no idea he owned, because it wasn't on the journal. On the journal that I kept, it was only the Chase National shares. And I eventually gave this little vignette to Nelson DeMille. He used it in his book Gold Coast. It's on page 46. That was my story.
Fascinating. Well, Alan, thanks for joining us. Great to have you on the line again. And hopefully we can circle back around and have another conversation in 2018.
I'd love to.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Alan Newman. You can find Alan's work at crosscurrents.net. That's crosscurrents, crrents.net. Very valuable. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. And feel free to call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.